The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Who is Hackberry Holland?
My new novel, House of the Rising Sun, is centered around a character based loosely on people in my family. His name is Hackberry Holland, a former Texas Ranger who in 1916 finds himself down in Revolutionary Mexico trying to find his son with whom he had lost contact over the years. It's really the story of Abraham in search of Ishmael.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. The award-winning author James Lee Burke is with me, and we're here to talk about his novel House of the Rising Sun, which is the latest in his Hackberry Holland series. Well, you dedicated House of the Rising Sun to the memory of John Neihardt and A.B. Guthrie, and wrote, there would probably be no American West without their work. Mm-hmm. So do you mind saying more about that dedication?
Sure. I knew both men, and I'm really glad that you drew attention to the dedication in the book, because they're of enormous importance as writers, and they were of enormous importance to me. John Neihardt was my first creative writing teacher at the University of Missouri in 1957, and Pearl and I both knew him quite well. And we used to go out to his farm, and he had a tank there where we used to fish. He was a mystic and the man who wrote The Cycle of the West, from which the story of Hugh Glass, the mountain man, and Jim Bridger and Andrew Henry was, in effect, he gave that story its legendary characteristic. He gave it an art form, and it was written all in poetic meter. But I think the film that just came out with Leonardo DiCaprio is based on that story. Also, Man Alone in the Wilderness with Richard Harris was based on that Neihardt story. But more importantly, Neihardt wrote Black Elk Speaks. And Dr. Neihardt, he was friends with Buffalo Bill Cody and Eugene O'Neill and Max Bodenheim. And he knew all the old Greenwich Village poets, and he lived there in 1905. I couldn't believe I had him as my teacher. But every writer about the frontier, from Louis L'Amour to, you know, some of our contemporaries, me, Cormac McCarthy, I think they would all say, yeah, Neihardt opened the door. Everyone's indebted to him. A.B. Guthrie, Bud Guthrie, was the first person we met in Missoula. Pearl and I had just pulled into the faculty and student housing. We had an apartment. And I said, I'm going to walk over to the tennis courts and see what's going on. And there was this man hitting on the wall, and he introduced himself. And I'd never read him before. And he said, I'm Bud Guthrie. And we played tennis. And later we went up to his ranch in Choteau. He was just a great guy. But I believe that the Big Sky is not only a Homeric book, it's as good as Homer. And I believe it's as good as Ulysses. I cannot for the life of me understand why A.B. Guthrie is not studied. I taught him for years. But his two books, The Way West and The Big Sky, are just incredible encyclopedic poetic statements about the opening of the American frontier. His talent was enormous. He was a titan. I don't know. There must be some explanation. It has a lot to do with the academic world. In the academic world, nothing is more unpardonable than having commercial success. They torture the poor guy for all eternity. I don't know how to explain it. And I had a good life teaching. I shouldn't say all. Well, no, it's a fact. It just take some poor guy like Edgar Allan Poe, who dies of opiate and alcoholic addiction in the back alley of Baltimore. So this is our kind of guy. So,
as long as you're not
we
successful.
Can relate. You know, my cousin was Andre Debuse Sr., applied for Guggenheim fellowships for years, and finally wrote an honest letter, and he said, "I've been grading papers for 20 years written by kids who hate literature. I just had my third divorce. I'm paying alimony and child support. I have nothing left." "I need some time off so I can write, for heaven's sakes." And he got a Guggenheim. Said, "Here's the real deal. This guy's a straight shooter. His life's a total wreck." "20 years of grading freshman composition papers. It's the ninth circle in Dante's Inferno."
Oh, you're really challenging me here, because I'm not sure how to get back to your book now. All right. Well, if you can take a couple deep breaths, let's just hear you read a little bit from chapter one, and then we'll we'll talk about House of the Rising Sun.
Okay. This story, as I mentioned, begins in Mexico in 1916. The sun had just crested on the horizon like a misplaced planet, swollen and molten and red, lighting a landscape that seemed sculpted out of clay and soft stone and marked by the fossilized tracks of animals with no names, when a tall, barefoot man wearing little more than rags dropped his horse's reins and eased himself off the horse's back and worked his way down an embankment into a riverbed chained with pools of water that glimmered as brightly as blood in the sunrise. The sand was the color of cinnamon and spiked with green grass and felt cool on his feet, even though they were bruised and threaded with lesions that were probably infected. He got to his knees and wiped the bugs off the water and cupped it to his mouth with both hands, then washed his face in it and pushed his long hair out of his eyes. His skin was striped with dirt, his trousers streaked with salt from the dried sweat of the horse. For an instant he thought he saw his reflection in the surface of the pool. No, that was not he, he told himself. The narrow face and the shoulder-length hair and the eyes that were like cups of darkness belonged on a tray or perhaps to a crusader knight left to the mercies of Saracens. "Venga," he said to the horse. "You have to be instructed to drink. It's no compliment to me that the only horse I could steal is probably the dumbest in Pancho Villa's army, a horse that didn't even have the courtesy to wear a saddle." The horse made no reply. "Or is stupidity not the problem?" the man said. "Do you simply consider me an ogre to be feared and avoided? Either way, my sensibilities are fragile right now, and I'd appreciate it if you'd get your sorry ass down here." When the horse came down the embankment and began to drink, the man, whose name was Hackberry Holland, sat on a rock and placed his feet in a pool, shutting his eyes, breathing through his nose in the silence. It was a strange place indeed, one the Creator had shaped and beveled and backdropped with mountains that resembled shark's teeth, then had put away for purposes he did not disclose. There was no bird song, no willow trees swelling with wind, no tinkle of cowbells, no windmill clanking to life, the spout drumming water into a galvanized tank. This was a feral land, its energies as raw and ravenous as a giant predator that ingested the naive and incautious, a place closer to hell than to heaven. He longed for a firearm and a canteen sloshing with water and a tall crown hat and a pair of boots and soft socks and a clean shirt. It was not a lot to ask. Death was bad only when it was degrading, when it caught you sick and alone and lying on sheets soiled with your smell, your fears assembling around you like specters in the darkness. "You see those two strings of smoke up on that mountain?" he said to the horse. "I suspect those are cook fires built by your former owners or by bandidos that got no use for gringos from Texas. That means we're going to have to cross those mountains north of us, and other than the grass growing in the sand, there's probably not a cup full of feed between here and the Rio Grande. You think you're up to that?" He rested his palms on his knees. "That's what I thought," he said. "So I guess the big question is, what are we going to do?" "The answer is, I got no idea." He stared at the water rippling across the tops of his feet. A great weariness seemed to seep through his body, not unlike a pernicious opiate that told him it was time to rest and not quarrel with his fate. But death was not supposed to come like this, he told himself again. His fingernails were rimmed with dirt, his belt taken from him by his captors, his toes blackened with blood where they had been systematically stomped. He looked up at the sky. "They're already circling," he said. "They'll take me first, then they'll get to you, poor horse, whether you're breathing or not. I'm sorry it's worked out this way. You didn't do nothing wrong." The horse lifted his head, ears forward, skin wrinkling from a blowfire that had lit on his rump. "What is it?" Hackberry said. Then he turned his face to a breeze blowing down a slope not over 100 yards away. No, it wasn't simply a breeze. It smelled of mist and trees, perhaps pines, and thunderheads forming a lid above canyon walls. It smelled of cave air and fresh water and flowers that bloomed only at night. It smelled of paradise in a mountain desert. "You reckon we found Valhalla? It's either that or I'm losing my mind because I hear music. You think you can make the climb up there, old pal?" This time, Hackberry didn't wait for a response. He picked up the horse's reins and led him up the embankment on the far side of the riverbed, convinced that his deliverance was at hand.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with James Lee Burke about his novel, House of the Rising Sun. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, it's available online as a podcast and at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. You can also get there through our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be back shortly to find out why Hackberry Holland is wandering around Mexico and why he has such a bad temper. Don't go away. We'll be right back. What is a bootless Hackberry Holland doing riding around Mexico on a stolen horse?
Okay, the story is based on a real incident, a historical incident. Pancho Villa's men raided across the Rio Grande a couple of times. The most infamous was the raid on Columbus, New Mexico. He killed a lot of people. And then he also raided into Texas and killed some people right there on the border. And the response was a John Pershing's punitive expedition into Old Mexico. And that's where many of the leaders of the American 20th century military had their first war experience. George Patton was with Pershing. He was the second lieutenant. So was Douglas MacArthur and others. And anyway, though, Hackberry went down in search of his son, who was a young captain named Ishmael Holland. When we meet Hackberry here, he has escaped from captivity. Pancho Villa's soldiers had captured him after he and the other Texas Rangers had fired on a train that had civilians in it.
Which is a heartache to him.
That's it. And Hack is ridden with guilt because he killed innocent people. He didn't intend to, but that's what happened.
He's very intelligent, but he doesn't seem to be able to control his temper, which he blames on this. You write, quote, "The curse of his family, the one that caused him to curve his palm around the grips of an imaginary revolver in his sleep, was always with him," end quote. Mm-hmm. So by 1918, when a lot of the story takes place, he has managed to alienate pretty much everyone he knows by drinking and fighting too much. So why can't he just get a grip?
Well, that's a good question. You see, at that time, people did not understand the nature of what we call clinical depression today and alcoholism. And the characters in my book, as I say, are loosely based on it. Historical figures in my own family, but I didn't change the names. The patriarch in my mother's family was Sam Morgan Holland, who was a violent and drunken man, and eventually, well, it's a long story, but he trailed cows up to Chisholm right after the Civil War. He came back from the war. He's a Confederate soldier. And he had trailed 2,000 head up to Abilene. And the night before he was to sell his cows, there was dry lightning, and they got loose on him. And he said he chased cows all over northern Indian territory. That was Oklahoma. And in the morning, he came back to his camp, and it was trodden into splinters and strips of canvas. He had lost everything he owned. And he said he cursed God for his bad fortune. And he said only three, I had a part of his diary. Sam, great-grandpa Sam, as everyone called him, said only three words went through his mind, whiskey and whiskey and whiskey. And he stayed drunk in the saddle all the way back to Texas. And he joined the New Hebron Baptist Church there in Yoakum. That was the inception point on the Chisholm Trail. And he used to sit each Sunday on the mourner's bench. In the old Baptist church, the mourner's bench was for people who were considered past the pale. And, of course, it's clinical depression. And unless a person has been in it, he will never understand it. He can never explain it to others who haven't been there. Psychiatrists used the metaphor of the Garden of Gethsemane to describe it. It's called a Gethsemane experience. It's like going to hell without dying. And for the person, the sky literally turns to a piece of carbon paper, and that's the world in which he lives. He lives in a black box. But anyway, Sam in his diary said that one Sunday that depression lifted from his life the way a veil of ash would rise from a dead fire, and it was over. And he became a preacher, a saddle preacher, and he preached on the Chisholm Trail the rest of his life. But he killed nine men in duels, and those are the ones he counted. Others, I mean, no one knows. And when he was maybe in Mexico or in Indian Territory, he was a dangerous and violent man, but it was something in the bloodline. And his daughter was Allifair Holland, who was my grandmother, And my daughter is named Allifair, so it's a very unusual name. The only other time I've seen that name written outside of our family, referred to outside of our family, is in the history of the McCoys. Allifair McCoy was a daughter of Randolph McCoy, the patriarch of the Kentucky people who feuded with the Hatfields. Anyway, so in this story, Hackberry finds the Grail. It's an ancient grail, and it's in the hands of an arms trader, and Hackberry steals it. And it's a story, actually, I borrowed it, of course, from the Arthurian legend, and it is the most emblematic and iconic story in Western literature. It appears again and again. It goes back to Celtic legend, you know, the horseman racing across the sky in search of the bowl that never needs to be replenished.
One of the things that I really enjoy about talking to you is that you write these great books, but then the backstory to the books is just as fascinating.
Well, that's it, but it's the human experience. That's it. It's incredibly intriguing when you begin to realize the great wealth of cultural experience that we seem to inherit, that it's in the unconscious. And Carl Jung, you know, subscribed to that belief. And in fact, Carl Jung wrote the introduction to the English translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And he used the Tibetan Book of the Dead as a kind of metaphor to explain the replication of the human experience from the time we first climbed out of the sea and flopped around on the sand. I mean, all those things are still with us. But the mystery of creation, to me, is just the most intriguing quest of all. Unfortunately, I don't think we ever figure it out, though. That's
why it's a mystery.
That's why it's a mystery.
Well, there are three women in Hackberry Holland's life. Tell us about them.
They're great characters, and my favorite women characters in my fiction. There are some other great ones, but these three ladies together are just heck on wheels. We meet Maggie Bassett, who is my attempt to give a second life to Lady Macbeth, because when she gets even, she really gets even. And she's based loosely on another historical character, the lover of Harry Longabaugh, the Sundance Kid. And if you remember, there was a man here. He died in the Palace Hotel fire, remember, in 1972, Robert Longabaugh. He always claimed to be the Sundance Kid's son. And no one's quite sure.
In Missoula.
Yeah.
The palace in Missoula. Yeah.
He obviously had some connection with him because of the stories he knew. But also, his family lived around a place in Oregon where Longabaugh lived when he was hiding out. And we also meet in the story one of my favorite characters of all time. And that's, my head went blank. She's an IWW organizer.
Hackberry's the love of his life.
His common law wife.
Ruby.
Ruby Danson is a great lady. She's an immigrant orphan girl that Hackberry met in Galveston. And she was an organizer for the IWW, the International Workers of the World. She was also at the Ludlow Massacre in 1914 or 15. That's when these poor people were trying to organize a miners' union there in southern Colorado. And the state militia and Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller's goons, killed many people. And I've been down in that cellar where I think it was 11 women and children died. They were hiding, trying to hide from the machine guns and the burning of the camp. And they went into a cellar and they were suffocated to death. But it's an eerie experience to climb down in that cellar. Gee, it's out on this barren piece of windswept prairie right on the that runs right into the side of the Rockies. But the other character is a lady who is a descendant of Jacques de Molay, who was the Templar knight who brought back the Shroud of Turin from the Holy Land during the Crusades in the 14th century. And legend has it he also brought back a cup and tradition had it that it was the cup that the Templars or the knight since Arthur's time had been looking for, used by Christ. And so this is where the Grail legend figures into the book. And there is actually a Grail in a little town in Spain that has a lot of the appearances, the traditions, the paper chain that takes it back to the Crusades. But no one will ever know. But it's cut out of a rough stone. It's not a golden grail. Jesus would have been called a peasant then. We'd call him a working man today. But he would not have access to a golden bowl, of course.
I'm really curious about your process. You have all this information in your head. You're constantly reading and doing research, I assume, while you're writing. And how do you bring it all together in your characters? Do you make a list of who you want to be in there and then decide who they are?
Well, no, I appreciate the compliment, but I don't do much research. I do read a lot, though. I read a lot. I've always enjoyed reading historical works. But it's my own feeling that, you see, all these things are still with us. They're not really historical. We're walking today in the same sand, same footprints of the British and of the French. The neocolonial issues of the 19th century were the issues of the Great War and the Second War, and it's the same in the 21st century. Nothing has changed. The same players are still there. It's the same thing today.
If I counted correctly, House of the Rising Sun is your 36th book. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I've published 34 novels and 2 collections of short stories.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
That's quite an accomplishment. You've been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. You've won 2 Edgar Awards.
Yeah, 3.
And they gave you something called the Grand Master in 2009.
That means you're old. That means you can hear your liver rotting on a quiet day.
And some of your books have been made into movies. Yeah. And then there was a short film that I saw last winter.
It's up for an Academy Award.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're writing, do you think about any of this, or are you just all clued in on the story you want to tell?
It's the latter. I'm very fortunate today because I can write full time, but the people who really, in terms of heroic behavior in the literary world, are those who get up before work in the morning and write and come home at night and try to write when they're tired. That's when it's hard.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about House of the Rising Sun?
No,
besides read it,
besides,
yes.
If you do read this book, I hope you enjoy it.
James Lee Burke lives south of Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.